Soccer is the most popular sport in the world. But, of course, most of the fans don't call it soccer. This hour, the international language of sport. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. English language expert Patricia O'Connor is here today. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language, and she blogs at grammarphobia.com. Today, she's here to talk soccer or football. With the world in the grip of World Cup fever, we'll talk about the language of soccer, rugby, gridiron, and football, and find out why some words mean different things in different countries. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Soccer is the most popular sport in the world. In the U.S., we love to play soccer, but getting us to watch has been an uphill battle. But even Americans are tuning in to the World Cup this year. In honor of the World Cup, we're going to talk about the language of soccer and other sports this hour. English language expert Patricia O'Connor is here today. She is the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language, and she blogs at grammarphobia.com. Hello, Pat.
Ready.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we are watching soccer. The world plays soccer, but very few other people ever call soccer soccer.
Yes, and there's an interesting story there. Everybody knows that the game that we call soccer is known as football or some variation on that name in most other countries. For instance, in Spanish, it's football. In German, it's Fußball. French, football or le foot. Portuguese, football, and Russian, football. My accent, of course, is wrong, but you get the idea.
Right.
They generally use a form of the word football, the English word football, for what we know as soccer. And I'll get into why that is. Interestingly, although people in England don't call soccer soccer, that's where the word originated more than a century ago. It was a slang term for the older word football. And here's a story. In late 19th century England, students at the big private schools, which we would think of as, they call them public schools, we would think of them as private, but
okay.
Rugby, Harrow, Eton, schools like that, particularly rugby, they began forming slang words by attaching the suffix ER to shorter forms of nouns. And the practice spread to other public schools from rugby, spread on to Harrow and Eton, and from there it spread on to Oxford University. Typically, an existing noun would be clipped and then ER attached to the end. And among early examples are footer for football, ecker for exercise, brekker for breakfast, bonner for bonfire, cupper for intercollegiate cup match. And perhaps more familiar to Americans is the later example, bed-sitter, which is a short for bed-sitting room, which also was originally school slang. Now, it turns out that soccer was one of these schoolboy formations. It was a slang term for association football. That is, football played according to the rules of an organization called the Football Association, which was formed in the 19th century to standardize the game. In this case, the ER suffix was added to a clipped form of association,
okay, A-S-S-O-C. So taking the middle part of association.
The middle part of association. They took the S-O-C, added ER, called it soccer. Sometimes it was spelled S-O-C-C-A to reflect the British pronunciation. Sometimes it was written S-O-C-C-A, soccer. But it boils down to S-O-C-C-E-R, which was the standardized spelling. And as the OED explains, this was derived from A-S-S-O-C, short for association. Now, the dictionary's earliest published example is recorded in 1899. But in Britain, the slang term soccer never replaced the original word. This happens sometimes. Slang words, as you know, come and go. And this one went. It went out of use pretty much in Britain. And it never replaced the original football, which England had been using since the early 1400s for various kinds of games involving people kicking balls around on a field.
Right. It's a very sensible name for the game.
Foot and ball.
Right.
Yes.
So how did it come to the United States? Why do we use it?
Well, let me continue
okay.
in the game.
I'm getting ahead of myself.
Right. The conventions of the modern game of English football were standardized in the 1860s when the Football Association drew up its rules. At that point, people who played association football were calling it soccer for slang, and people who were playing another kind of football, which was popularized at rugby, were playing what they called rugby football. So you had association football and rugby football. Association football was known by the slang term soccer. Rugby football was known by the slang term rugger. So soccer and rugger originated as slang terms for the two varieties of English football, which are still played today. Rugby has different rules. You can pick up the game and run in rugby.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like American football. So today, North Americans use the former slang term soccer to differentiate the kind of football we play from that played in the rest of the world. But when football came to the U.S., the rules changed right away. It more closely resembled rugby. The rules changed on from there. So we had a brand of football all our own, which we kept calling football. And we used the term soccer for what was played in the rest of the world. In fact, the United States Soccer Federation was originally known as the United States Football Association. But, of course, it had to change its name because it would have been confused with our football.
Right.
So that's why when people watching the World Cup are cheering, they think they're watching football. But Americans aren't the only ones watching soccer. Of course, it's the same in Canada. They call it soccer. Australians use the term soccer to differentiate their sport, which they call footy sometimes, from which is a kind of mix between soccer and rugby. They call what they play soccer. And there are people in the Caribbean and in Afrikaans, they sometimes use the word soccer.
And someone told me that in Japan they call it soccer.
Oh, they do. That's interesting.
So
you know, the world at large, you might ask, well, what do they call what we play?
Mm-hmm.
What the Vikings play? It turns out that many English speakers outside North America use the terms gridiron or grid. So they say American football or gridiron. Now, the word gridiron itself has an interesting history in English. It's been around since the 13th century, so it's as old as football. But gridiron started out as the name of a cooking apparatus. It's probably related to the earlier word, griddle. And gridiron consisted of bars made of usually iron, set in a parallel formation, supported on legs for cooking over a fire. Later it was used for things of a similar grid pattern, like a grating or a grill, or in the 19th century it came to be used for the markings on a sports field. And that's why in Britain, in the late 19th century, people started using the term gridiron to describe the white lines laid out on an American football field. So that's why gridiron stuck in some English-speaking countries for what we play. And we sometimes use the term gridiron as a
right.
sort of nickname.
To sound more dramatic.
Right. But that's why there's so much confusion between their term football, our term football, and the term soccer, which is used in some places and not in others.
Well, it's interesting because there's also quite a bit of derision, I think, attached mm-hmm. to the fact that we use the word soccer and people in England will say, of course it's not soccer, it's football.
Yeah, well, what do they think we're supposed to call what the Vikings play?
Right. Well, they may argue that we don't use our feet nearly as much.
It was a practical decision to differentiate between these words. So, they were playing it first, granted. But what we play now is a different game.
What you mean?
Yeah, what we play is not the football that was association football, okay, or rugby football, or footy, which the Australians have adapted as their own sort of football. So anyway, we're just going to have to live with it. The truth is that American football in the United States is a more popular game than soccer. I mean, soccer may be the most popular game in the world, but in the U.S. it's not the most popular game. More people, I'm sure, are going to be watching the Super Bowl than the World Cup.
We certainly. It is interesting, though, because so many people now play soccer,
yes,
in the United States,
yes,
although it hasn't turned into the spectator sport that one would expect after all of these,
right,
kids grow up playing soccer.
Sure. I think one reason that soccer is catching on here is because kids are growing up playing soccer. It's been adopted in schools. And that brings up another interesting derivation, the term soccer mom, which is, it started out meaning moms, and it usually was the moms, I guess, who haul the kids to and from the games. Maybe one mom might volunteer to pick up the kids and take everybody and bring them back, drop them off at their homes. And, you know, there are, of course, soccer moms and dads rooting from the bylines. We see that out here. I live in Connecticut, and on Saturdays when there are inter-school soccer games going on, I mean, it's wall-to-wall cars, it's wall-to-wall parents on the sidelines, and it's like Little League. You know, they're really in there rooting.
Right.
The term soccer mom is interesting because it later became a term for a demographic, not necessarily a mom who actually does this, but a certain kind of voter or consumer, say of a certain age with kids, maybe living in the burbs.
Who drives a minivan.
Middle income, drives an SUV or a minivan, that kind of thing. It became a demographic term.
Interesting.
Among politicians and marketers.
And again, a term that was able to be used with derision by some individuals,
yes,
as well.
Yes.
It's interesting how there's a theme for the hour.
Yeah.
We are going to take a short break, Pat, and we will be back. We'll talk more about sports language around the world, but we also want to hear from you. If you have questions about the language of sports, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or if you have general questions about language or language pet peeves to share, feel free to jump in there. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we have with us English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She also blogs at grammarphobia.com. We've been talking about the language of sports, specifically where that word soccer came from and why we use it when so much of the rest of the world does not. If you have questions about sports terminology, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we know that you have language pet peeves and questions about the language. If you have a question or a pet peeve to share, again, give us a call, 866-780-9100. And Pat, we were just talking here in the studio during the break about the word foul, because foul is something that is used in almost every kind of sport.
Uh-huh.
And we were wondering where that came from.
Oh, well, right. You know, it has a general meaning in the ordinary language of something that's, there's something wrong with it.
Right.
You know, it actually dates back to before written language. It was recorded before 800 in Old English, and it developed from an old English word spelled F-U-L, more or less, that meant dirty, impure, vile, rotten, or corrupt. So it's always meant some sort of corruption or some wrongness. And linguists have even reconstructed what it was like before there was writing. Supposedly, there was an old Indo-European root. This is way back in prehistory. That meant, and then it was spelled with a P. This is before the great consonant shift, which is something else to talk about. But it was spelled with a P, poo, meaning something that smells, that stinks, something purulent. Later, a lot of these P words, by the time they came into English, were spelled with F. The same thing happened with pater and father. So at any rate, in Middle English, foul meant the opposite of fair in various meanings. Thus, foul play meant unfair conduct, while fair play meant fair conduct. And so it was sort of given that it would be adopted into the language of sports. The phrase foul ball dates from 1860, and it came into American English first. Foul ball, but foul play is much, much older than the United States.
And it went from being an adjective to being a noun.
Yes, a foul. And that's just a shortening of foul ball.
Interesting. Well, we have callers on the line who want to join in this conversation, and you're welcome to join us as well. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mary is up next in Ames. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
Well, it's just a comment more than anything. You were talking earlier about soccer versus American football and the terminology associated with that. And as I suppose I would have been considered a soccer mom too, having had a son that played. And I've always thought that American football would be better described with the name tackle ball.
Mm-hmm.
Since that's really what happens in the sport. And then soccer would be football. But alas, mm-hmm. The naming will change now. But
right? Did you try to make that catch on, Mary? Did you?
Oh, just in my own household, and people just looked at me like, "No, that's not. It's the National Football League. It's not the National Tackleball League."
But you're right. So, when I think of football, I find it almost hard to watch because I hear that clashing of the helmets, and it makes me cringe. I suppose that's a girl thing.
It's a sensitive individual thing.
Crashing, and I think, oh my gosh. And I see somebody falling on the field and 8 300-pound guys falling on top of him or jumping on top of him. And I think, holy moly, there's going to be nothing but a big grease spot left on that field. I mean, I can never believe that they all get up. But sometimes, of course, they don't.
Right.
I have the same reaction, and that's why I thought tackle ball is suits it better.
Are you glad your kids are playing soccer instead of football?
Health-wise?
Injury-wise?
It nothing to do with that. They just had an interest. My son just had an interest in soccer and actually was a runner in the fall during the American football season.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mary.
Also, in soccer, they get to do more running, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover.
They run a few feet and everybody stops. Run a few feet more, everybody stops.
Mary, thank you so much for your call. And moving away from the sports language, Shannon is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. I was just wondering, I hear locally here people saying things like, she sure smokes a lot anymore. It's a positive usage of anymore. Is that just a regional dialect thing? Is that a shift? I mean, I guess I'm just wondering if that's just here local or not.
It's not local to Iowa. But it is heard in a few parts of the country. It's heard in the South, and it's heard in the Midwest. I don't know about the Southwest, but linguists have written a lot about this because we think of anymore as being used in a negative sense, like, I don't go there anymore. But people also use it in a positive sense, as in, we eat a lot at that restaurant anymore, meaning lately. or recently or nowadays. And it's become, it's not considered bad usage or anything like that. It's a dialectal, regional thing that's becoming more and more common, used with a positive statement instead of a negative statement. So nothing wrong with it.
All right. So, Shannon, has it been bothering you?
Yes, it does. It bothers me. But that's my other one is irregardless.
Well, irregardless, there's no excuse for that one.
Okay.
We kick it out of the club. It's off the island.
All right, Shannon, thank you so much for your call. You can join our conversation with questions about the language of sports or also just your pet peeves about the English language, questions you'd like to ask our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org.
Now, I could add one thing to Shannon's question.
Sure.
I just looked up any more in the most recent edition of the American Heritage Dictionary, and there's a usage note there that says, in standard American English, the word anymore is often found in negative sentences, as in, they don't live here anymore. But anymore is widely used in regional American English in positive sentences with the meaning nowadays, as in, we use a gas stove anymore. That one was recorded in Oklahoma. It says this usage is especially associated with the South Midlands and Midwestern states, as well as the Western states that received settlers from those areas. The earliest recorded examples are from Northern Ireland, where the positive use of anymore still regularly occurs. So it could be that if you have people who were of Irish heritage who emigrated in the 19th century to the Midwest or to the middle southern states, that may be why you say anymore in a positive way, or why you don't. If you have Scandinavian relatives, maybe they don't do that.
Okay, interesting. Well, and it's, you know, she mentioned it being heard in Davenport, which of course is relatively southern for Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard it, but I don't hear it very often.
Well, you don't? I used
no.
to hear it a lot when I was growing up in Des Moines.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to the phones. Peg is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Peg.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have a question, and I think I first started to hear it with sports celebrities and then announcers, and now even our president says it. When did they start saying "tuh" instead of "to"?
Oh, yeah, that's not a recent thing. And
really?
The reason you think it's recent is it just made an impression on you recently, and now you think you're hearing it everywhere. You are hearing it everywhere, but it's always been a pronunciation of the word T-O. We once wrote an item on our blog about this, that "to" can be pronounced either "to" or "tuh." And you'll even find those pronunciations in dictionaries. It depends on what follows. For instance, if you were following it with a hard consonant, like "I'm going to New Zealand next year," you see, I barely touched the T. It almost doesn't have a vowel there. "I'm going to New Zealand. I'm going to New Zealand. Going to New Zealand." You might hear the word T-O, but you're really just... I'm only pronouncing the T, really. Now, but if I followed it with a vowel, "I'm going to Oklahoma," I would probably stress the O to differentiate it from the O in Oklahoma. If you have two vowels together, you're going to be more careful of pronouncing that first one. "I'm going to Alabama." "I'm going to Uncle Fred's house."
That's so interesting. And I would have thought
that it depends on what comes after it.
I would have thought that it would also be dependent on what comes before it, the kind of conversation that you're having. Because when I think of it, I think of somebody in a very relaxed speech.
Well, you only hear it in conversation.
Right. But "I'll take you to the cleaners," you know,
right.
That kind of
cleaners
thing. If you have a "yeah," then it would be followed by a "ta."
Cleaners. Well, and "the" is also a word that has a different pronunciation depending on what follows. and the article a or a. It's pronounced differently according to what follows.
It's interesting. And having an emergent reader in the household, we've had a lot of conversations
right.
about that because he's so frustrated when he just reads the word a.
Uh-huh. Wants to say a.
Right.
Right.
And then it sounds wrong to him.
Right. Right. But sometimes we do say it as a if we want to stress it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did you buy a couple of new basketballs for the kids? No, I bought a basketball.
Uh-huh.
Meaning one. You're stressing the article. But if you said, just in ordinary conversation, you'd say, I bought a new basketball. I bought a basketball.
Pat, I know that you pay close attention to the language. And as you just said to Peg, it's bothering her because she noticed it. And now she hears it all the time.
There's a name for that phenomenon, the recency illusion.
All right.
Yes. For instance, if you hear someone ending a lot of sentences or ending a lot of verb or subject phrases with I instead of me, as in come along with Jerry and I instead of Jerry and me, if that somehow you become aware of it, it registers somehow in a different way in your brain. You'll start noticing it more. We had this happen to us when we bought a Subaru. We bought a Subaru in 1998. We started seeing them everywhere. There were no more Subarus on the road before we bought ours. But once we bought one, we saw it everywhere. It's the recency illusion again. Because something comes home to you, you start noticing it more. And you think it's recent. Oh, this is a new thing happening. Well, it may not be new. It may have been there all along. You just weren't picking up on it.
Interesting. Well, Peg, thank you so much for calling. And Pat, do you have any advice for people who want to stop being annoyed by something that they're noticing more than they used to?
Well, I don't know. How do you become? I get annoyed at some things too, but I guess I get more annoyed when people use language in a hurtful way. I don't know. I guess just have a little perspective on what's going on. Take the time to learn about it. We do a lot of work on our blog about things that people find annoying. Like another, someone mentioned using any more positively.
Mm-hmm.
We get a lot of mail about that. We also get a lot of mail about the car needs washing.
Right.
Well, needs washing, don't you mean needs to be washed? Well, needs washing is a very common idiom. And so we write about things like that. And I think if you know where they're coming from, how frequent they are in the language and why people say that, why the structure of English leads people to want to say things like that, then I think you aren't annoyed as much about it. You know,
right.
If you educate yourself, you learn not to be annoyed about it.
Well, Peg, thank you so much for your call, and I hope this helps you let go of it. Phil is on the line next in Fairfield with a very similar topic. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'm afraid this may be a recency illusion, but I have to test it out. I've recently noticed, and it irritates me for some reason, is that people use the word T-H-E before a vowel sound. I was taught to use, before a vowel sound, you say the egg. Before a consonant, like basketball, you say the basketball.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I hear
the
even
egg.
NPR announcers on Iowa Public Radio saying she put the egg on the apple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not really recent either.
Jeez.
My husband and I we have an old Nat King Cole record from it's either the 30s or the 40s. Is it Sweet Lorraine, the song? Anyway, he talks about he's looking forward to walking down the aisle. And that always hits my ear because I think the aisle. Actually, it's not incorrect. You said you were taught to say it a certain way. It's not that people are taught those pronunciations. It's just that it's easier to say it that way. That's how they evolved. It's easier to say the apple than the apple. The apple, you've got sort of a glottal stop there. The apple. You know, it's like, uh-oh, you've got a little hump there to get over. But if you say the apple, it flows naturally. So people who use those pronunciations are making their pronunciation a little more difficult, I think. I'm not sure that it's wrong. I don't know that there's a rule anywhere that says you have to use the before a vowel and the before a consonant. It's just that that's the convention because that's the easier way. And it's the convention because it's the easier way, you know? And it's the easier way because it's the convention. So this is a circular kind of argument. Anyway, it's not that they're mispronouncing.
Okay.
It's just that they could be making things a lot easier on themselves.
All right. Well, Phil, thank you so much for your call. I hope that settles it in your mind. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We started out the hour talking about the language of soccer and the language of sports around the world. If you have questions about that, feel free to give us a call. But also, if you have language pet peeves or questions about the English language you'd like to ask, again, 866-780-9100 is the number. With us, English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, is here with us today. She is the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She also blogs at grammarphobia.com. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Marilyn is on the line next in Mount Vernon. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I have a pet peeve about language, and it is, I think it's because I'm just noticing it. It's the word I mean. I see so many people start to talk and give a little talk or a little blurb, and then about the second phrase is I mean, and then they go on to explain themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of a nervous tick or a way of filling.
Right.
Filling language. Right. A lot of people email us about how people use the word so in the same way. They'll, to fill a spot, they'll start a sentence with so, you know, to give themselves time to think or to come up with what they want to say. And I think they'll use I mean in the same way.
So instead of saying
Yeah, or,
Right. Well, it's interesting to me how something like this proliferates, because we actually have a caller on the line who wants to talk about so. We have an email from Sam in Johnston. He says, mm-hmm. Could she address the use of the word so to begin sentences?
It seems. See what I mean?
Right.
Lots of people write to us about that.
Right. It seems the more educated the person is, the more apt they are to use this word to begin a sentence. It may be perfectly appropriate, but to me, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I am curious, because now maybe the more people complain about it, the more I hear it. But it does seem like something that we hear more, and we do hear things like that proliferate.
I think that is genuinely more recent. We started getting questions about this in, like, maybe 2007 or 8, and people were hearing it on interview programs on television and on radio. And the people who emailed us about radio said, This is really common on NPR. And with scientists and so on, the interviewer would say, so, you've done your book about blah, 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 blah. Tell us a little about it. And the interviewee will answer, so, what I wanted to do with this was, and they're using so as filler.
Right.
There are a great many ways to use the word so. It serves a lot of functions in as different parts of speech. And so it was kind of sitting there. See, I just used it.
Right. Well, the more you hear it, the more likely you are to use it, right?
Consequently. I was using it to mean consequently.
Right. But the more you hear it, the more likely you are to use it.
Exactly, especially if you're listening to radio a lot and TV a lot. It will impress you as, even unconsciously or subconsciously, as a legitimate conversational ploy, something that's done for rhetorical purposes and is natural to do. And I think for a lot of people it is becoming natural. But boy, do we get a lot of mail about it.
Right. Well, and I think the preamble to the question is something that happens a lot because we are trying to soften a question. This is, as an interviewer, I think about this because sometimes asking a question feels rude.
Might seem abrupt.
Right. And so you do try to come up with ways to...
Right. A little buffer.
Right.
Buffer words.
It's interesting. This stuff fascinates me. Let's get back to the phones and talk about something that's fascinating. Somebody else. Steve is on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question about?
Well, I'm interested in how words become derogatory or they become cleansed. There's controversy about the Washington Redskins as being a terrible name for a football team. And yet we have words like Sioux City and Sioux Falls, and I think Sioux is a derogatory term for the Lakota Indians. Also, Squaw Creek. We have squaw everything in Iowa, and that's a derogatory term.
A lot of
doesn't seem to have the sensitivity of maybe Redskins.
Yeah, a lot of those words, those ethnically derived words, have been kind of scoured out of the maps and out of the geographical locations over the years, but not all. And I think for people who live in those areas who are familiar with those terms and don't really think about the derivation, it's a little bothersome to have to change. And I think if you are hearing from people who say, I'm genuinely bothered by this because it hurts my feelings, that's one thing. If no one's coming up to you and saying, this bothers me, I mean, I can't see why you would do it. Now, take the word squaw. It began as a word in the Massachusetts language, an Indian language, Native American, S-Q-U-A. It was spelled in Massachusetts. Younger woman, it means. Well, it later became offensive when used in the mouths of white people. Now, the same thing has happened with a great many other words. They started out being used within the group, within the minority group. When the usage spread to the majority, it became a slur. The N-word, for example. Early on used in the South as short for the word Negro, but, of course, almost immediately used derogatorily by white people, so it became offensive to the minority, except when used among themselves. This is a really complicated issue, and it really would take a psycholinguist to discuss this. There you go, Charity.
Right,
you
should another show.
Get somebody from the university to come in and talk about the mechanics of psycholinguistics. When do things become offensive? Why do they become offensive? How do things become cleansed so they're not offensive anymore?
Interesting. Well, Steve, thank you so much for bringing that up, and that does sound like something we should spend a lot more time talking about, but not necessarily this hour. Let's go back to the phones. Lou is on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, Lou.
Hi.
What's your question about?
I don't know if this is a recency illusion or not, but twice in one day, I was confronted by a weight person who queried us as to whether Hugh Geise's party was all ready to be seated, and the question I had was I hadn't been aware of any proper use of the plural possessive of guys.
Yeah, you know that's very interesting because we actually did get a question on our blog once about this, and we researched it.
Oh, really?
When you start considering guys or a word like guys as a generic, sort of a collective singular noun, how do you make it plural? You can't add an apostrophe in your mind to the word guys and have it sound like a plural to the person you're speaking to, so you say guises. You know, now that wouldn't be the way you'd write it, but in speech, if you're thinking of guys as a plural noun, you'd make it possessive with zzz, another zzz sound.
Or you could just move the word in the sentence and say it a different way.
Yeah,
does
you
this
could.
Belong to you guys?
Yeah, you're so sensitive, Sherry. you could just rephrase it entirely. But when you're speaking to someone, people speak awfully quickly today. Mm-hmm. Especially young people. I sometimes get, you know, you get help on the phone, like tech help, say.
Yes.
From a person who's very obviously young. Of course, they know anything about computers. They have to be young. And they speak so fast. And I often have to say, would you mind slowing down a little bit? A lot of that went right, whizzed right by me. And I know I sound like I'm, you know, 70 or 80 years old, which I'm not yet. But anyway, the point I was making is that when you're speaking, especially rapidly, if rapid speech is what you do, you don't have time to rephrase.
Right.
You say, you guyses.
You have to go with whatever. Whatever's coming
car?
Out of your mouth right now.
Yeah, are you bringing you guyses' car with you? You know, that kind of thing. So,
all right.
Yeah, it's odd.
Let's go to...
Standard English, no.
Right. Let's go to Julie on the line somewhere in Northeast Iowa. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I was just wanting to ask our expert of the day about the word sport itself and connotations. I know there are a variety of meanings, even though he sported a yellow shirt, made sport of someone as a verb. But the root of it is a basically somewhat insubstantial thing. It's just to divert oneself or have pleasure. And we take sport, it's, well, obviously for money reasons, it's such a big deal anymore. And I wonder if anyone is aware of the origins, that it's kind of a not such, not that pleasure isn't important in life, but it's not that big a deal. And I just wondered if you could just talk about the word sport itself.
Right. Well, it's been in the language since about the 1300s, I guess. And it was borrowed from there was a longer word earlier, disport. And we still say disport. You disport yourself in such a way. But it was a shortened form of disport. And it meant a pleasant pastime or an amusement or a diversion. And it, you know, later on it meant recreation, sports, amusement, whatnot. Now, the meaning of a good fellow, as in be a sport or that kind of thing, that came along only in the 20th century, and it was short for sportsman, which was a 19th century term. So sport was a short word for sportsman. The sense of sport meaning a game came along in the 16th century, and it usually meant a game involving physical exercise. So for instance, if you were playing poker, you would call it a sport because you're not up running around the table. At least you shouldn't be. So there's also a term in biology, a variation sport. It came from an earlier phrase, a sport of nature, which means a spontaneous mutation. In other words, something. Say you have you have zinnias in your garden, and they seeded themselves, and one of them came up really weirdly formed, not looking like a looking more like a peony or something. You could call it a sport because it was a mutation. So there are lots of different words, and we say sports here to mean, you know, recreational sport in general. They use the singular in Britain, sport. And there's also an adjective, sportive, that means playful or merry. And we have a lot of different adjectives, like sporty, for instance, like, oh, that's a sporty-looking jacket you're wearing. meaning it looks like something a sportsman might wear. That might have been the derivation. But it's true. It didn't mean the whole reason for existence, you know, as it seems to mean now. I read something funny lately by Dave Barry on the subject of baseball, and he said, he was talking about the difference between men and women in baseball. He said, a woman, if faced with the choice of catching a fly or saving the life of an infant, would save the life of an infant without regard for whether there were even men on base. Now, he's, of course, he's grossly exaggerating.
Right.
But there are people for whom this is the whole purpose of life. It's, you know, the only subject of conversation. It's all they want to watch on TV, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess it's better than, you know, doing drugs or something like that. Although it can be harmful if you start putting money on it, you know.
I don't know where to go with that, Pat. Okay.
Okay, well, the caller was wondering why, you know, sports was it was something that meant just an amusement, a diversion from life.
Right.
From life. It wasn't supposed to mean life.
The meaning of life, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, we're going to take one more question. This is Kayla in Des Moines. Hi, Kayla.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I was hoping that we would be able to settle a debate that my friends and I have been having for literally like 10 years. Is it kitty corner or catty corner?
Well, it's both. I'll tell you why.
So no, we cannot settle that debate.
It actually came from French. And the original term was cat, meaning four corners, four-cornered. And if you move from one diagonal of the four corner to another, you're going catch corner. That's the derivation. I know it sounds weird, but it actually has been spelled and used both ways in English almost from the beginning, and I think it's from the early 19th century, kitty corner and catty corner. And they were just different impressions of what the French sounded like, which was cat corner.
All right.
And Q-U-A-T-R-E.
And if you just want to sidestep it, you can say diagonally.
Yes.
But really,
sidestep in more ways than one.
Right. You can go either way with that, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Is it regional?
No.
No.
It's all over the country. You can say kitty corner or catty corner, and I'm sure they're both used all over the country.
All right. Very interesting. Well, Pat, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
And I'm sure we will talk again soon. Patricia O'Connor is an English language expert. She's written a number of books about the English language, including Woe Is I. She also blogs at grammarphobia.com. So if you didn't get a chance to get your question answered today, go on over to her blog, grammarphobia.com. She and her husband have written answers to many, many of the questions that get asked. So you can search for yours, or you can submit your question as well, or wait till she comes on again next time. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Dennis Reese. We have technical assistance today from Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. On the show tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day.